start greeting you with shalom.
Shalom.
God, that's God's peace, God's wellness, God's health. That's being debt free. Wouldn't that be great? It's all kinds of health, economic health, physical health, spiritual health, relational health, community health. So shalom.
Shalom.
So the topic of this week's Bible study is crossing borders, intercultural encounters in the First Testament. After last night's homily, I should say intercultural engagement. How about that? Okay, so I changed my title, intercultural engagement in the First Testament. And if you remember, those of you who are here, the first session on Monday was about the city of Babel, commonly known as the Tower of Babel. And we looked at that not so much as a story of pride and punishment, but as a story of the cradle of civilization, an etiology or an explanation of the origins of different languages and cultures in light of God's delight in diversity. And then yesterday we looked at the story of another liberation from slavery and another journey towards authentic relationship with God by Hagar, the Egyptian slave of Sarai and Avram, or Sarah and Abraham, and how her son, actually the oldest son in the family of Abraham, was circumcised with Abraham at age 13, and it was Hagar who received the promise of a multitude of a great nation, and who named God the God of seeing. She's the only person in the Bible who names God. Amazing. An Egyptian slave woman. So the Bible offers glimpses of other people's journeys, even as it concentrates on the story of the Israelites, since it's Israelite literature. And I think that's inspiring, can be inspiring for us, that we can get to know the stories of other people that we live alongside as authentic stories, as inspiring stories, as stories of faith. And someone asked me, what is this? And the reason I chose this photo, this is Mecca in Saudi Arabia, and this is the site of the pilgrimage to Mecca by Muslims who see Ishmael as the father of faith, the line through which the Arabs trace their descent. And the tradition is that Abraham and Ishmael established this pilgrimage site here at Mecca. And there is a well also, Zamzam, that is known as the well where the spring where Hagar was searching for water and she discovered water. So that's part of the pilgrimage. So what we read in our Bible, you know, is enacted actually in the Hajj to Mecca. So today I only have one slide. This one. Kind of blurry. How disappointing.
What? Is that Michigan? Or?
I was going to ask you, yeah, what do you see here?
Tell me more.
I just, boy, just ran out of steam. I don't know. So, yeah, anybody see anything in this at all? You see something Egyptian there. Someone sees like an Egyptian, like walk like an Egyptian or something. What is she doing here? Like this, something like this? So it's a female figure. Actually, this, I'm not able to interpret it as fully as I would like because I'm not an expert in this area, but from what I understand, these are figures of midwives or goddesses, and this is a birthstone. You know, they in Exodus, they talk about the birthing stones. And I guess women would squat on them when they were giving birth in order to give the room, give some room for the baby, right? Because if you're just on the ground, no one could. So, but they're not that big. But anyway, so I thought, well, this is an interesting symbol for today's emphasis on the first two chapters of Exodus. Yes?
Is that an image of a woman giving or receiving a baby? Is that something in her hand?
This one here?
Yeah.
Awesome. I see, like, there's one figure here.
In the center.
One and two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said, I'm...
giving or receiving something.
As I, it does appear, doesn't it?
Well, she has three arms, correct?
I know it's a birth scene. Kneeling. Well, if she's kneeling, then maybe that's the one, if there's one who's kneeling. So, okay, your assignment for next summer is to do a little extra research in the Phyllis. I'm sorry, I don't, you know, sometimes you can find those line drawings where the artist is actually doing an interpretation so you can see what's happening, but I didn't have that available to me, so.
Where
did, it's an Egyptian birthing stone.
Do you know when? What era?
Such good question. So do you see? Yeah, okay, so you see a hand? Anyway, it was given to me by a student, she has her doctorate, Claudia Bergman, and she is now, I think, in Germany now, but she did her PhD at the University of Chicago, and it was on the image of birth in the prophets, and how images of birth are used to express, like, being out of control, panic, and so forth in the prophets. She gave a talk in a class that I had, and I asked her for this, and I just was able to find it, but I don't have the details. Anyway, so today we're going to actually look at the first two chapters of Exodus, sort of the prequel of the Exodus narrative, and I thought it would be good to just read a longer narrative of Scripture. You can turn on the lights, because you need to do here. This isn't going to be a highly visual day today. So I thought we would read the whole two chapters, get a longer stretch of the narrative, and have you look here in these opening chapters for foreshadowing of resistance to the Pharaoh. Who are the characters who emerge in resisting Pharaoh's authority, and we'll especially concentrate on the adoption scene as we continue. But if we could just start, do you want to start here and just read a verse and go around and
just chapter one, verse one.
Just chapter one, verse one. Yeah, we're just gonna have a long read here.
These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan, and Naphtali; Gad, and Asher.
Good job.
All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already.
Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and that whole generation.
But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them.
Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we.
Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, for they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land."
Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them for forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses, for Pharaoh.
But the
more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel.
And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor.
And made their lives miserable by forcing them into cruel slavery. They made them work on their building projects and in their fields, and they had no pity on them.
Oh, good. Now the next person, why don't you read from 15 to 22, just to, so we don't have all...
Then the king of Egypt spoke to Shiphrah and Puah, the two midwives who helped the Hebrew women. When you help the Hebrew women give birth, he said to them, kill the baby if it is a boy, but if it is a girl, let it live. But the midwives were God-fearing, and so did not obey the king. Instead, they let the boys live. So the king sent for the midwives and asked them, why are you doing this? Why are you letting the boys live? They answered, the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They give birth easily, and their babies are born before either of us gets there. Because the midwives were God-fearing, God was good to them and gave them families of their own. And the Israelites continued to increase and become strong. Finally, the king issued a command to all his people, take every newborn Hebrew boy and throw him into the Nile, to let all the girls live.
Okay, great. You want to, the next person you want to read from first chapter down, you can to 10.
During this time, a man from the tribe of Levi married a woman of his own tribe, and she bore him a son. When she saw what a fine baby he was, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could not hide him any longer, she took a basket made of reeds and covered it with tar to make it watertight. She put the baby in it and then placed it in the tall grass at the edge of the river. The baby's sister stood some distance away to see what would happen to him. The king's daughter came down to the river to bathe, while her servants walked along the bank. Suddenly she noticed the basket in the tall grass and sent a slave girl to get it. The princess opened it and saw a baby boy. He was crying and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Then his sister asked her, shall I go and call a Hebrew woman to nurse the baby for you? Please do, she answered. So the girl went and brought the baby's own mother. The princess told the woman, take this baby and nurse him for me and I will pay you. So she took the baby and nursed him. Later, when the child was old enough, she took him to the king's daughter, who adopted him as her own son. She said to herself, I pulled him out of the water, and so I named him Moses.
Very good. And let's just finish the let's finish the chapter, just to go on a bit. next person can read.
How far?
Say to 22. Or 25, yeah.
One day Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and saw their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinfolk. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, he saw two Hebrews fighting, and he said to one who was in the wrong, why do you strike your fellow Hebrew? He answered, who made you a ruler and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known. When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh. He settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. The priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But some shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and came to their defense and watered their flock. When they returned to their father, Reuel, he said,
"How is it that you have come back so soon today?" He said, "An Egyptian helped us against the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he? Why did you leave the man? Invite him to break bread." Moses agreed to stay with the man. He gave Moses his daughter, Zipporah, in marriage. She bore a son, and he named him Gershom. For he said, "I have been an alien residing in a forest land." After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of the slavery, their cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them.
All right, and all this happens before the Exodus, in Exodus. who did you notice first of all as the first resistors?
The midwives.
Good. And so
I found it interesting that they named the midwives.
Because
they don't always name any. I mean, Pharaoh doesn't even have a name.
Right. Pharaoh means great house. And he's the king.
Yeah.
The guy who lives in the great house, the palace, right? So Pharaoh becomes sort of a proper name for like all the pharaohs, right? Mm-hmm. Good. But what are the midwives' names? And don't say I don't know and I don't care.
Shiprah and Puah. Okay. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing them right, but
now Shiprah and Puah, good. Now there was a professor that I had, and he said that on one of his doctoral exams, one of the questions was, "Name the two midwives," and he said, "I don't know and I don't care." He got it wrong.
Not a good answer.
Shiprah and Puah. Now, you know, what kind of names are those? Those are kind of Shiprah and Puah. Shiprah and Puah. Interesting. Don't sound like common Hebrew names, but anyway, so were they Egyptian? Interesting. They were midwives to the Hebrews. It says Hebrew midwives are actually, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. A little ambiguous, actually, in the Hebrew, whether they're Hebrew midwives or whether they're midwives for the Hebrews. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. They just have two of them? How many people are there?
Yeah.
They're
busy.
They're really busy. What's that?
No wonder he missed the
birth. Right. So what about that response when Pharaoh... Pharaoh is really intimately involved here, giving him instructions, right? When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women. See, now they're midwives to the Hebrew women. And see them on the birth stool. Now, this is a birth bricks. So.
I just got to say, once we're talking about these midwives, the chutzpah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Because Pharaoh was Pharaoh.
Right.
Pharaoh.
Uh-huh. And for them just not to kill the boys and leave the girls to live to produce more slaves. The children would take the identity of their father in this time. So he would render the people without their male protectors and so forth, and those that gave the cultural identity in that context.
They also believe at that time that the male basically had the baby in the sperm.
Yes,
so,
right.
The,
mm-hmm.
So if there's no males, there's no
right, the
children.
Seed. Uh-huh. So basically males mm-hmm. had seed and the woman was the field. Uh-huh. So mm-hmm.
But no seeds, no babies.
Right. Mm-hmm. No babies. And the women would be fields for other seeds. You know, Egyptian seeds or whatever. So anyway. But they feared God. Okay. So this is a great example of what Lutherans would call vocation, right? That they practice their vocations, their callings, with integrity. And just in their own role, bringing babies to birth, they continued to do that because that was their calling, right? And they were not going to let Pharaoh make them into killers, right? They were givers of life, right? Very impressive. And you all laughed. when they got called in before Pharaoh. And would somebody read a different version of what they say when he says, "Why are you not following my order?"
Mine says, "The midwife said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous, and are delivered before the midwife comes to them.'"
Okay, good. Does anybody else have another translation?
They are lively.
They're lively.
They're not slow like the Egyptian women.
They're not slow like the Egyptian women.
Well, Egyptian women have to walk more like this.
Oh, man. That's great. Well, let me just check that. What verse is that?
19.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It says, "Vatomarna ha meyaladot." The midwives is from a verb meaning yalad, to give birth. So they're the ones who facilitate birth. So that's their vocation, and that's what they continue to do. They do not waver, even when commanded. This is civil disobedience, right? They're going to bring on childbirth. And it says, "Lo kanashi," not like the women, "ha mitzriot," like the Egyptian women, are the Hebrew women, "ha ivriot, ki hayot heina." Hayot can, high, you know what high means, l'chaim? Life, right. You could say, okay, they're lively, they're vigorous, they are, you could say, they are animals. Whoa. So in a way, probably they're playing on Pharaoh's and the Egyptians' prejudice, you know, about a foreign people, that they're more like animals. You know, they just give birth. They're just dropping all over.
Like rabbits.
Right? Like mice. You know, what's he going to add? That's probably a cultural prejudice, you know? Like the Egyptian women, they need, you know, they need the midwives. They need the rituals, the incantations. You know, they're very delicate. Ah, these Hebrew women, they just give birth. So what's he going to answer to that? It's like, oh.
He believes them, that's what's even funny.
What's that?
He believes them,
right. He's God. Apparently believes them. It's like, okay, well, that was failed. Yeah. There's nothing you can do about it. What's that?
He obviously knows nothing about really what goes on.
What really goes on.
That's true.
I'm surprised he believed them, I don't think, because he thought of them as a much lower class than himself.
Yeah.
So therefore, they said like animals or whatever.
Just like animals. They're just animals. Yeah. So it seems to me, this is an interpretation, of course, but it seems to me that they are using his prejudice as a way of continuing, right, to just let the population go and become more. And interesting, now the first time, when does God first act in Exodus? To my recollection, the first thing God does is to deal well with the midwives. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's the first thing God does, is he gives them families. So they let everybody else have families. And so God gives them families. That's the first act of God in the Exodus story, is to give the midwives family. What a joyous, joyous act there. All right, any other observations about this this first event? Yes, uh-huh.
I have one comment.
Sure.
The interesting thing here is that the Egyptians had many gods, and they feared even Pharaoh as, look upon Pharaoh almost as a god.
Mm-hmm.
And here when it says that the midwives did what they did, wasn't necessarily, doesn't mention here that they had compassion for the children, but it said that they feared God.
God.
So maybe by spending so much time with the Hebrews, they had a change of faith,
uh-huh.
started fearing their one God, and
uh-huh.
not the, or respecting as much, their Egyptian gods.
Uh-huh.
So, and that may be also why God blesses them.
Very good. So the fear, they fear, but they don't fear Pharaoh. Their fear of God liberates them from fearing.
They started to fear the Hebrew God.
The Hebrew God. And they don't fear Pharaoh as Osiris or what is it? In some texts, the Pharaoh is considered to be divine. Yeah.
But he certainly had the power to have them. I mean, they could have had them.
Uh huh. And aren't they clever though?
Aren't they?
Because they're using, I think, his own cultural prejudices.
Can you imagine the relief, the laughter yoga moment they must have had?
Can you imagine them planning what they were going to tell Pharaoh?
Not me.
We pulled it off.
We pulled it off. Yeah. Okay. What a great story. Oh, marvelous. So I'm glad you're laughing because really, I just think there's such great humor in all of this, and to be able to laugh at it's such a terrible thing. I mean, we're talking about genocide here, a plan for genocide, but there's the laughter in that. The Shifra and Pua are able to pull it off. Not only that, they get their own families as well. But then Pharaoh commands his people, every boy that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live. So now he's not trusting just two midwives, but a general command. Okay, so who do you have next? The next resistor? Next up?
Moses'
mother. Yes, okay, good. So this is, they're Levites. Okay. She hid him for 3 months. Now, is that possible? Mothers, can you hide a baby for 3 months?
Yes.
Good. Okay, you can. Okay. How can you hide a baby for 3 months?
They mostly sleep.
They mostly sleep anyway, don't they? Okay. Good. Mm-hmm. All right. So what happened? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, in VeggieTales, if you've ever seen that one, they show the guards coming in, and Miriam's just changed the diaper, and she's waving the diaper in front of them, and they back out. So. They never look to see if it's a boy or a girl.
She hides him for 3 months, and then she couldn't hide him anymore. Now, what's her strategy?
Throw him in the Nile.
Yeah, so she obeys the Pharaoh's order. She's to throw him in the Nile. She just happened to take a few extra precautions, right? Make a nice papyrus basket and plaster it with bitumen and pitch. You know, the basket here, it's the same, teva is in Hebrew, it's the same word as the word for the ark, teva. So that's kind of a beautiful detail, isn't it? It's almost as if all of Israelite history is sort of precariously, you know, life being carried forward on this fragile vessel on the water. But literally, she does obey the Pharaoh's command. So she throws him in the Nile, or puts him, among the reeds. And interestingly, this word for reeds, it's suf, it's the same word as Yamsuf, the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds that later the Israelites cross. So there's all these little links to the story that comes. And he's not left alone, but there's the sister who can live, right? Who's placed as guard over him. And now I love this next part with the daughter of Pharaoh coming down to bathe at the river. And so you have someone from Pharaoh's own family, the daughter, coming down. And she sees this basket. She has servants, of course, and they bring her the basket. And what do you think about her motivation? When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying. She took pity on him. This must be one of the Hebrews' children.
She's defying her father.
Mm-hmm. And
I think she has a mother love for a baby.
A mother love for a baby. Uh-huh. So she has compassion, pity.
We don't know whether she had any children or not. Right?
No, we don't know that.
Don't know that she was married.
No, we don't know that either. Huh.
Well, and what her relationship was with her father.
Oh. I never thought
of that. Her father was built. And one of his slaves tattled on her that she did that with the Hebrew baby. Because she knew what she was doing.
Yes, she knew what she was doing. She knew that there was an order, right? Because she knows it's a Hebrew boy. So, very, very interesting. So she has compassion, and Miriam. I love Miriam. Miriam's not named here, but it's assumed that it's Miriam. Since it's always these three, right? It's Aaron, Moses, and Miriam that show up. Suggests that she could get a nurse from among the Hebrew women to nurse the child. And so this is another beautiful case. The mother gets to nurse the child and get paid for it. Well, so let's take this as a, this should maybe be an example for our society to give mother's wages. What's that?
I think it's really interesting. Typically, it's about resisting, thinking about force, right?
Force, yes. Uh-huh.
That seems to be more a male kind of way, but the women really are smart. And resist. In a different way.
Right. So Moses' mother gets to keep the child past 3 months. She gets to nurse the child. She gets to do it with protection from the Pharaoh's daughter. And she gets paid. So what better could you have? Well, I used to think that this was so funny that, probably Pharaoh's daughter didn't even know that the nurse, the wet nurse, was the mother. I thought that was hilarious. But now I think it's more like an open adoption. I don't know. It doesn't really tell you, right? So it kind of depends on your own lens. And now that I have 4 open adoptions, now I'm more like, oh, come on. Pharaoh's mother knew. Pharaoh's daughter knew that was the mother. That's anyway. Who knows? I don't know. But Moses' mother takes the child and nurses it. When the child grew up, when it was weaned, right? How old would that have been in that culture?
Up 2 years.
Yeah, even 3. Mm-hmm. Even 3 or 4, 3 and a half. Uh-huh.
No, I think it'd been older than that. She would have had a chance to inculcate him with the religious beliefs, mm-hmm. and then to go into Pharaoh's court. I think he was the first split personality.
Hybrid, huh?
Brought up Jewish and then goes into the Egyptian court. And mm-hmm. Poor guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always pictured him as being
Charlton Heston.
I wasn't going to say that, but yeah, sure, I do actually. Yeah. He did a good portrayal. Yeah. So probably, I think maybe 3 or whatever, I don't know. But it's interesting, he spends a long enough time in the Egyptian court that what do the daughters of the Midianite priest, Raul, who's also known as Jethro and Hobab, he has a number of names in the narrative as it continues. What do they say in 2:18? Their father says, "How is it that you've come back so soon today? An Egyptian helped us." He's an Egyptian in their eyes. Isn't that interesting? He's not a Hebrew. He's grown up, and he's
culturally
he's an Egyptian, probably with his speech as well. He, you know,
Maybe he did learn Hebrew as a child. Maybe that was his first language, and he was able to speak it, understand it, because he's understanding, you know, the Hebrews as they're fighting and so forth. When they say that great thing, when they say, "Who made you ruler and judge over us?" Well, God does eventually, but.
Well, he's a resident of both worlds and maybe neither. Maybe not quite at home in either world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A professor at McCormick Theological Seminary gave me an interesting insight or a possible interpretation of Moses' words when he protests. You know, God comes to him and says, "Go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people go." And he has all these excuses. You know, they're not going to believe me, but God. And then he finally says what?
He's stuttering.
"I'm a man of uncircumcised lips."
Yes.
Now, what does that mean? Maybe he doesn't speak Hebrew fluently. Maybe he knows the words, but he doesn't know the idioms. He doesn't know the rhetorical patterns. He doesn't know the expressions. He's not going to know what to say to them. What about that? So what does God say? "Don't worry, Aaron, your brother, can talk." Right, because he grew up. Now, how did Aaron escape? There's a whole other story you don't know. Right? Well, maybe he's the elder, right? Is Aaron the elder? So perhaps this was before the decree. But anyway, so Aaron, the brother, speaks for Moses, and perhaps because he is more fluent and more comfortable in the Hebrew idiom. So this, you know, this is one possible interpretation. This isn't definitive, but I thought that was fascinating. So we really do have Moses as a kind of a intercultural, a hybrid figure. And if you look as things go on, what else does he do? Well, he marries a Midianite woman, and then later in chapter, I think it's 13 of Numbers, he his sister and brother accuse him of marrying a Cushite or Ethiopian woman. Now, they think Midianite and Ethiopian were the same, or these two women. It's not really developed, but he's a hybrid character in his marriages as well. He negotiates a lot with different kings, different groups and so forth. So perhaps he's in a unique situation. As you say, he knows both worlds and perhaps not fully comfortable in either, but is able to go back and forth. He has the access to the Pharaoh's court. He feels comfortable. He knows, you know, where the door is and how to get in, and he'd be recognized and so forth, right? Yes?
So the Israelites identify him as Egyptian, but yet the daughter looks at him and knows right away he's Hebrew.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Because so ethnically, mm-hmm. I mean, would they have similar skin tones, similar mm-hmm. facial features?
Do you know, let me see if I can find that one that I had yesterday of... this is an Egyptian depiction, and I'll show you the real thing, too. This is from Beni Hassan. This is from a tomb. The Egyptians portray themselves as having a darker skin, and they wear nice cotton, cool cotton whites. You know, they look great. And then you have the Asiatics. These are the people from the East, and they're actually lighter skin, and... and they wear wool. It's wool. So this is an Egyptian depiction of some racial difference.
Would Moses have been circumcised when the princess found out?
I don't know.
8 days.
That's 2 days.
Well, but before they left Egypt, Moses had them all circumcised again. It's almost like since Abraham started the whole thing, it's kind of dropped off over the years, because before they leave in the Exodus, he circumcises all the males again.
All the males.
All the males have to be circumcised.
Right.
So obviously they weren't done as children
right.
by that point. At some point it dropped off.
At some point it dropped off. Well said.
He did.
You guys are really good at words. I wanted to, there's a, this curious story of when Moses goes back to Egypt. Here it is in chapter 4. Now, Zipporah, his Midianite wife, Zipporah means bird, so her name is Birdie.
Birdie.
Zipporah. Moses is finally like, okay, I'm going to go back home. Even though God says, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart, so it's like, oh boy, this is going to be a lot of fun. Look in chapter 4, verse 24. On the way, at a place where they spent the night, the Lord met him and tried to kill him. It's not easy being the weird. Is that weird? But Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it. You know what? This is a kind of an interpretation that her son's not... I think it just says, cut off his foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, truly, you are a bridegroom of blood to me. And he let him alone. It was then, she said, a bridegroom of blood by circumcision, and their lives are spared. Now,
that is so weird.
That is so weird. That is really strange.
Well, now, like, feet is a euphemism for something a little more personal, right? Mm-hmm.
Of what?
Feet is a euphemism for something.
Oh,
more
the feet.
Personal.
Yeah, it could be, touch Moses' feet.
Where she
Yet feet, for a male, feet can be the genitals, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The loin area. Mm-hmm. That is very strange. It seems to be some ancient tradition that they kept in here, but yeah, it's really odd. And you almost like to leave it out, but what do you see here? First of all, they are not circumcising. Either Moses isn't circumcised, or the son's not circumcised, or something strange. And who knows what to do to come to the rescue?
So if she's trying to hide Moses, she wouldn't want to circumcise him and cause him to cry. That maybe.
No, it's Moses.
But when you're talking about Hebrew boys not being circumcised.
Yeah. Well, okay, so somebody's not...
If you have a practice, it stopped being a practice, you could be right. So they could hide them, they stopped circumcising.
Oh,